This is Thin Blue Crime, a true crime podcast discussing some of America's most dangerous criminals, the police, examining both the crimes of the past and current movements to imagine a police-free future. Today, we will be covering the story of Larry Bembenet, a police officer who once challenged the discrimination and corruption in her precinct. However, did Lori go on to commit murder herself? Tune in.
Hi, I'm Hannah.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And we are back with Thin Blue Crime, your friendly neighborhood abolitionist podcast extraordinaire. And we got a crazy episode for y'all this week.
I'm really excited.
Like I said last week, this week we will be covering the story of Laurencia Lori Bembenet. And let me just say, this is like a smorgasbord of criminal activity by the police. Like, there were some twists and turns in the crime saga here. So let's get into it. Laurencia Ann Bembenet was born August 15th, 1958 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was a Leo, relatable. She was the youngest of three girls. Her father was actually a cop as well, but quit because of what he described as corruption in the department.
Oh, okay.
The only good cops are cops that quit. Let me just say that.
Kind of sly.
Very sly. She was raised Catholic and attended school in Milwaukee before getting an associate's degree in fashion merchandising from a small school in Virginia Beach. She briefly modeled after college before entering the Milwaukee Police Training Academy. I wasn't able to find exactly why she wanted to be a cop. I have to think it relates to her dad, but I'm also like,
right. Girl,
did you not listen to your dad say that it was corrupt?
Right. Maybe she was like, I'm going to change it. If he just had one person that would have listened to him or something like that. Because Maybe it was like a specific departmental thing and someone got fired or something. You know, maybe he didn't.
Maybe
he wasn't like, the institution of policing is oppressive. You know,
maybe. I think she'll learn very quickly that the institution of policing is just corrupt. Anyway, as a trainee, she did well, allegedly graduating near the top of her class, though she did have some issues. During her training, there was an anonymous tip that came in saying that she had smoked marijuana at a party. The claim was never substantiated, and she denied the charge. She says that she believes the accusation came from a jealous police officer's wife who felt threatened by her. But ultimately, she was still able to graduate. It was no problem. She eventually went on to work in the Milwaukee PD's Southside 2nd District. In her documentary, because she does have a documentary out there, I think it's called Run Bambi Run. We'll get to that in a second. I didn't, like, not a spoiler, but we'll get to that in a second. Chris, I see you laughing. We're going to get to
There's
it.
There's a lot to unpack there.
We're going to get to it, I promise. Like I said, she went on to work on the Southside 2nd District. And in her documentary, she claimed that the Milwaukee PD was full of brutal, lazy, apathetic, and corrupt police officers. She claims female and minority officers were routinely harassed and abused during training, and that they were often severely punished for minor infractions, while white men went largely unpunished for more serious offenses. Lori, I do gotta ask, why do you think your dad quit? Like,
I'm also like, what do you think cops do? You're just saying that, oh, in the police station, they treat minorities worse, but what, they don't on the streets?
And I think that's what, like, a lot of everyday people who, like, don't understand how, like, corrupt and evil policing in this country is, like, that is the idea that they have. Like, she, as a white woman, probably thought, you know, police protect me. They keep crime down. I'm safe with them. I want to do that. I want to protect people. So I'm going to go into that work. And then she gets in there, and this is the 80s, so it's even, I don't want to say it's even worse than it is now, because in some ways I think it's worse now than it was then, but it's bad, obviously. Nobody was respectful to women in the 80s, and she is like, oh, wait, people here are actually terrible. The guys that I work with are awful. There's a ton of corruption in this institution, and I'm treated differently. Yeah, girl, You are. Yeah. And that's why your dad quit. Anyway, this also actually, because she's sitting here, she's saying that she found that female and minority officers were severely punished for minor infractions, while white men went largely unpunished for more serious offenses. And that actually brings me to the situation with Tyre Nichols. Because Black police officers, and I feel like a lot of non-Black people don't know this, but Black police officers have a reputation of being more brutal towards particularly Black people. Look at the NWA lyrics, everybody. Mm-hmm. But it's because they feel pressure to, like, perform.
Yeah, they have oppression. Something to prove.
Yes, exactly. And I think the Tyre Nichols situation is very complicated because now there's stories coming out that it was a personal attack and all of these things like that. But originally people were like, Black police officers brutalized a Black man? That's shocking. And it's like, that's not shocking to me at all.
Yeah.
Because the issue isn't racist cops. The issue is cops. Like, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Also, though, let's talk about the way that all of the Black officers involved in that situation have, in theory, been held accountable. I mean, obviously they haven't because they're running around existing. But, like, they were fired and they were arrested and things like that. But when the video came out, we saw that there was at least one. I think now there's reports that it was two white officers there at the scene, one of whom was the one who tased Tyre Nichols. And those officers were not fired. One of them has been put on administrative leave. They loved to say, oh, they've been relieved of duty. Yeah, they meant administrative leave. He's on paid leave. He's not fired or anything. And has not been arrested. I personally think it's interesting that the Black officers were held accountable relatively quickly. Right. I mean, not really, but, and the white officers still have not.
Right. And again, like, obviously there's no justice, no accountability within our system, but, like, if we're going to pretend that these are the steps that we should take, there's no surprise that the Black ones are being held to this law and the white ones aren't, because that's just, that is the law.
Yeah. Anyway, also during her training in the academy, she had a roommate named Judy Zess, who was also in the academy with her. I guess the two of them attended a rock concert in the summer while they were, I think it was while they were still in training. That I'm not super sure on the timeline there, because this all happened over the course of a few months, and obviously police training isn't a long-term process.
It's a little blip.
So I don't know if they were still in the academy. But regardless, they attended a rock concert, and during that concert, Judy is arrested for smoking marijuana. Lori says that she didn't smoke at the concert, but Judy says that she did. Ultimately, both women are dismissed because of this incident. Judy because of the drugs, and Lori for what the police said was filing a false report. I guess when Judy was arrested, Lori was told to file a report as an off-duty officer. And in the report, she tried to protect her friend, and that backfired. And she ultimately was fired after only a few months on the job. It's very interesting to me that she was fired for trying to protect her friend, because what happened to the thin blue line? Was there not a thin blue line in the 80s? I thought they all protected each other.
Right, well, but that's the whole thing. It's a band of brothers.
You're right.
Not
so bad. Right. You're right. Well, anyway, Lori was not cool about being fired, which is also interesting to me because she acknowledges how corrupt and awful the institution of policing is. Why would she want to stay? But she was not cool about being fired. She felt like she was being treated unfairly compared to the male officers, which by all accounts she was.
Yeah.
And that other officers wouldn't have been fired for what she did. While she was grappling with this, she somehow gets her hands on a number of scandalous photos of several other Milwaukee PD officers. I guess these photos were taken at a naked party, and everybody was very intoxicated. And in the pictures, there were things visible that was not in line with Milwaukee PD policy. So Lori takes these pictures to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and argues that her firing was unfair as she was fired for a minor infraction and the photo showed officers committing much more serious violations, yet none of them were punished.
Mm.
The commission ultimately encourages her to file a discrimination report within Internal Affairs, but we don't know if anything comes out of that. And she just ultimately ends up working as a waitress at the Playboy Club in Lake Geneva. I just want to specify, there are several news outlets because the story around her went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
As you're gonna learn soon, because her story gets crazy. Her case had a lot of media attention, and a lot of those news outlets reported that she was a Playboy bunny, but she was not a Playboy bunny. She only worked at a Playboy club.
Mm.
I think that's a pretty important distinction, because while we don't respect cops, we do respect people's, like, we do respect people as a whole, and saying that someone was a Playboy bunny when they weren't, I think, is incredibly disrespectful and irresponsible reporting.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of crazy that, I mean, it's not, news, legacy news is terrible, but I think it's kind of crazy that so many news outlets were like, this Playboy bunny is a murderer, and it's like,
that sounds way better. That's what they care about. That yeah. sounds way better than this waitress at a Playboy club. Like,
no, you're right. And of course they would never say this cop.
Oh, no.
Even or though she was this actually cop
turned Playboy waitress.
And she was actually a cop longer than she worked at the Playboy club.
Mm. Interesting.
But the reporting didn't talk about her being a cop. That's why this case, I would have covered this case last season. It's so crazy. But the reporting didn't talk about the fact that she was a cop. They wanted her, they wanted that really disconnected from this story.
Right.
So interestingly enough, Lori's future husband, Fred Schultz, was one of the officers in those pictures that she took to the Equal Employment Commission.
Wow.
The background on their relationship is a little bit murky, but it looks like they met around the same time that she was actually taking the pictures to the Equal Employment Commission. And my conspiracy brain thinks that that's interesting, but we'll get to that in a second. Fred was a 13-year veteran on the force and already had two sons. He divorced his first wife, Christine, very shortly after meeting Lori. Mm-hmm. And Lori and Fred were married in January 1981. And the marriage was actually ruled by a judge as invalid because they got married so quickly after Fred's divorce that it violated mm. Wisconsin state law. Wow. And in Wisconsin, you have to have a 6-month waiting period between a divorce and a remarriage.
Okay.
And they violated that. They got married only 3 months after Fred's divorce.
Wow. But I mean, yeah, that's really fast. Also insane law, but
it is, but it isn't. Like, I actually think that that's not an under, like, it's a legally binding, you know, marriage is a legally binding contract. I don't think it's crazy that we're like, I don't know, you just broke that last contract. Maybe wait 6 months before doing another one.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But
it's government married, overreach in a gross
married
way.
At first sight. Like,
true.
I don't know.
I mean, first of all, the government has no business being in anyone's marriage, but I do think that that's not a law that makes sense, but like a rule of thumb that
yeah.
makes sense.
Oh, yeah. In terms of like personal ideas, yeah. Chill out. Relax.
Chill out. So anyway, like I said, they got married. All of this, she was fired in like September. And this is now January, just for like some timeline stuff. All of this whole case happens over the course of like a year. Like, it's insane. So at this point, Lori is working as a security officer at Marquette University and living with Fred, her friend Judy that we mentioned earlier, and Judy's boyfriend Thomas. On a just really small, quick note, she is a fired cop working at a university. And I think some of y'all need to know that that is not uncommon. A lot of mm-hmm. campus police officers are retired or former, under questionable circumstances, cops.
Yeah.
And I actually think that that's bad. I mean, obviously I think it's bad. Like, I don't think we should have police in general, but like on a college campus, I don't think it is making students any safer to have cops trying to relive their glory days around a bunch of irresponsible, impulsive, probably drunk students.
Yeah, who like really, and probably overly trusting too.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, let's talk a little bit more about Fred Schultz, the husband, because Fred had previously been in some legal trouble. In July of 1975, Fred was responding to a call in Glendale, Wisconsin, outside of his jurisdiction. At the scene, George Sasson, an off-duty police officer, had arrested a subject at a bar. When Fred responded to the call, which again is not in his jurisdiction, I don't know why he responded to this call, he mistook Sasson as a suspect, and when he saw him holding a gun, shot and killed him. He and his partner were both ultimately cleared by the shooting, but I thought that was dark and noteworthy in this story.
And in what, who is allowed to just accidentally shoot and kill someone who's not doing anything wrong?
Well, he was holding a gun. Never mind that I'm pretty sure Wisconsin's an open carry state, but he was holding a gun.
That's
literally, how dare he exercise the Second Amendment?
We literally incarcerate women for killing people who are like perpetually physically abusing them. And yet,
we just did recently. I mean, not we just, we do it all the time, but I just saw a story in the news about, a woman who ran a daycare who killed her husband, who was abusing the kids at her daycare. And they're sending her to jail for 20 years.
Yet a cop
can kill another cop and be let off the hook. Yeah. Him and his partner were let off the hook. Also, just a small note, but this is why the good guy with a gun argument doesn't work while we still have police. And I say that as someone who, like, my, like, most right-wing take is I'm a big Second Amendment supporter. And I think people, particularly people of color, should arm themselves. But, like, it's not safe for people of color to arm themselves. It's not safe for anyone to arm themselves with the state of policing in this country. Because if you can't actually exercise your Second Amendment rights safely without risking being shot by the police, you don't actually have that right.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. All these like NRA pro-gun people should be running against the police, like running, being like, they will kill you if they think you have a gun, which is your right.
If we could figure out how to get the right wing to realize that the police is also their enemy, God, would we be in a better position as a country?
Oh my God, it'd be over.
But they don't care because the police largely brutalize people of color. I mean, look at the situation with Philando Castile years ago when the NRA didn't say a single thing. The NRA didn't say a thing about a legal gun owner being murdered by the police just for owning a gun. Because those people don't care. They are also white supremacists.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lori and Fred are moving on with their lives. We're now in May 1981. Early morning on May 28th, Sean, Fred and Christine's oldest son, was awoken when a masked intruder tried to place a rope around his neck. He screamed and woke up his 8-year-old brother, Shannon. Sean then heard a loud bang before the intruder ran out the door. He then found his mother, Christine, gagged, bound, blindfolded, and shot in the back.
Oh my God.
Sean, who was 11 at the time, described the assailant as a masked male figure in a green army jacket, black police shoes, and having a reddish blonde ponytail. It's really important to note that black police shoes note, because his father, Fred, his father's new wife, Lori, both cops, and I think I had read that Christine's boyfriend was also a cop. So, like, there were a lot of cops in his life. So he knew what police shoes looked like.
Mm-hmm. That's not, like, weird for him to describe them that way. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing the police do when Christine is murdered is they look at Fred, obviously. We've all seen Law and Order. We know how that works. He says that he was on duty investigating a burglary with his partner, Michael Durfee, at the time. However, ballistic testing indicates that his off-duty revolver could have been the murder weapon. I think they suspected that the murder weapon was a 38, and he had a 38 at home. So suspicion quickly moves to Lori, mm-hmm. who had no alibi because she was home alone, sleeping, allegedly, at the time of the murder. And she had access to the gun, and she also had access to keys to Christine's house because her stepson had the keys. And yeah, at that point, they're like, we think it's her. Yeah. And they arrested her at her job on Marquette's campus. And they search her work locker and find a hairbrush with hairs that appear to be consistent with those found on the bandana used to gag Christine. At this point, she's ultimately charged with first-degree murder. Prosecutors allege that she killed Christine because she was angry about alimony payments and wanted Fred to spend less money on Christine and more money on her. During the trial, the media begins referring to Lori as Bambi, a nickname that she reportedly disliked. I don't really know where the nickname actually even came from, but she's been very clear that she does not like being called Bambi, so we're going to continue to call her Lori. Not that, like, we're just going to have some comedy and see respect for people. She wants to be called Lori, you know?
Call people what they want to be called. That's
fair. Yeah. So the prosecution, they portrayed her as a loose woman, addicted to expensive living. And I think that's, like, a story that when women are charged with crimes that we see quite often, is attacking their innocence and their,
finances.
Chastity. So the finances, yes, because women are all gold diggers, but also like their purity, their chastity, their innocence. Like, this is a loose woman. She's a husband stealer, things like that.
Yeah.
That storyline is so popular within the criminal justice system. And I think it just shows how misogynistic our system is.
Yeah. Well, because that's the second that women lose value. Like, we're supposed to be protect women, love women, take care of women, whatever. And then
until we open our legs the way that we want to.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Sean actually testifies that Lori was not the person he saw in the house that night. He says it was a man. But other witnesses testify that Lori owned a green jogging suit that would have been similar to what the assailant was allegedly wearing. And she had also purchased a wig similar to what the assailant had worn. The wig was later believed to be recovered actually from a shared drain pipe in Lori's apartment. They found this reddish blonde wig in the apartment's septic system, I guess. I don't think they had a septic. I don't know what the word is. You know what I mean? And Lori's friend Judy actually testifies that Lori had told her that she wanted to, quote unquote, blow Christine away. And they also found another man who testified that Lori had offered to pay him to carry out the murder. So ultimately, she's found guilty. Between all of these witnesses and the hair evidence, like, she was found guilty. And she's sentenced to life in prison. Fred immediately files for divorce following her conviction. Throughout the trial, he had said, no, she's innocent. I'm standing beside her. The second she is convicted, he files for divorce and writes her a letter informing her that he was now living with a 19-year-old girl in Florida. Great guy. Probably still a cop in Florida.
Probably.
Look him up, everybody. Fred Schultz. See if he's still a cop in Florida. While he initially had been saying that he believed Lori was innocent, he eventually turns on her and in interviews states that he believes that she is guilty as sin. But this is where the story stops, because Lori maintains her innocence and ultimately files for appeal, saying that she believes that she's being targeted for speaking out about the discrimination that she saw and the corruption that she saw in the police department. And I gotta say, I don't put it above police to do that.
Neither do I. And as you're reading the evidence, I was like, oh man, I mean, this is against her, this is against her. But who better to do something like that than the police themselves?
Well, and meanwhile, Fred's alibi slips. Because it comes out that he wasn't actually on duty when Christine was murdered, but he was drinking at a bar with his partner. It also comes out that the hair analysis used to convict her was faulty, and that the medical examiner originally concluded that the hairs recovered on Christine's body were consistent with her own hair, and only after a second test was done did they believe that it was Lori's.
Why would they do a second test? That's one. Also, seems really easy. Time card machines have been in for a thing for a very, very long time. Seems really, really easy to check to see if he was working.
Well, the other thing too, I saw this really interesting, I went to this seminar about criminal justice and how like crime TV shows like CSI, NCIS, Law and Order, all of those shows have actually really had a bad impact on juries because juries want to see all of this physical evidence like hair fibers and things like that. But the science is not actually really that sound for most of those tests. And it kind of can be a situation of like, well, which doctor do you want to run the dental checks? Which scientist do you want to run the hair fibers? Because like things can be changed. I remember hearing a story about a case where it was like bite analysis. And they found one expert that said, yes, this is definitely the bite of this person. This person is guilty. And another expert was like, no, but they just bring on the expert that supports their case.
Right, exactly. The lawyers interview the experts beforehand. And yeah, I read an article really similar to what you're talking about with how, yeah, basically all so much of the technology that's presented just
is bad.
It's either bad or just doesn't even exist. Like presentation.
And like DNA tests, like DNA has actually, that's relatively sound. But these other things, these hair fibers, these bite tests, these other little random stuff, those are not as accurate. A lot of that is theoretical or even pseudoscience in some situations.
And it's also important to know that witnesses are really, really unreliable, particularly eyewitnesses, but witnesses in general.
Well, it's so funny that you say that, Chris.
Oh,
because guess what? Judy's ass, she recants her statement and says that Lori didn't tell her that she wanted to blow away Christine. And even crazier than that, the woman who occupies another apartment in Lori and Judy's building testifies that Judy had actually knocked on her door and used the bathroom not long after the murder. And after Judy used the bathroom, the plumbing was all messed up. That is until they removed the reddish brown wig from the plumbing, and then everything was fixed. And Judy actually eventually admits to owning the reddish brown wig. Not the one that they found in the pipes, but just in general, she said that she did purchase one. Anyway.
Wait, that's weird.
It is weird. Remember, she was also a cop, too.
Well, I just did. That was not where I was expecting that to go.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot. Because Lori claims that the real murderer is a man named Freddie Horenberger. Not to be confused with her husband, Fred Schultz, because he did briefly work with her husband, Fred Schultz, on a remodeling project and was a boyfriend of Judy Zess. A disguised Freddie had actually robbed and beaten Judy Zess several weeks prior to Christine's murder and would later serve a 10-year sentence for that crime. Christine thinks that Fred hired him to commit the crime and have her take the fall for it. And she's spoken about it publicly. Freddie Horenberger did deny this. I guess there were some like jail confessions where I guess he had been bragging to somebody saying that he had done it, but he always denied it up until his death during another crime that he was committing. But very interesting the way all of those people are connected.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of crime, a lot of cops.
A lot of crime, a lot of cops. Anyway. While in prison, Lori earns her bachelor's degree. She helps found a prisoner's newspaper. She from all reports, was a model prisoner. And she actually meets and becomes engaged to a factory worker, Dominic Guglietti. That's a very Italian name. I'm sorry. I'm going to call him Dominic, who is her cellmate's brother. Unfortunately, though, her appeals are denied, even with all of the new evidence that she has. Oh, another just important thing is there was like a conflict of interest with her lawyer, where her lawyer was also like supporting her husband during something. And I heard on a podcast, I didn't find a news article about it, but I heard on a podcast that a separate set of police were actually looking at charging Fred Schultz for corruption. And that case was dropped so that they could pin this murder on Lori. Yeah. So there's so much corruption going on.
And that's crazy, because I feel like usually with appeals cases, like the one of the best chances is like something up with your lawyer. And so she had a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and she was sick of it because nobody was taking her seriously. So she decides to escape and conspires with Dominic, and ultimately ends up escaping by sneaking out a laundry room window. She tells the COs, like, hey, I'm going to just go and handle some laundry. She sneaks out the laundry room window, scales a barbed wire fence, and runs to Dominic's waiting car. Dominic had gotten them fake birth certificates, and they fled to Canada. They had actually decorated their card to say just married, and when they got to the border, they explained to the agent that their IDs had been stolen, but they were on their honeymoon. They were only going to be staying in Canada for 2 weeks. They had these birth certificates, and they were hoping that they would let them in. And this is pre-9/11, so the Canadian Border Patrol was like, I mean, yeah, sure, come on in. And they escaped. I wish y'all could see Chris's face right now.
Did they escape? Like, are they, like, for good?
So.
Damn, because I really didn't want to get my hopes up, because I'm like, wait, that's.
Kind of slay.
Like, major slay. What? I mean,
so this.
Still a cop. And...
Still a cop. But of all of the cops we've talked about in this story, I do think the least awful.
Yeah. I mean, more like pending the murder charge.
pending the murder charge. Everyone, all the other cops in this story sound also terrible. So if we have to support one, I guess it's going to be Lori.
Yeah, it's like, fuck, marry, kill. We're yeah. marrying.
Well, I mean, yeah, because her husband's also, Fred Schultz has also killed people. And Judy Zess sounds a little shady, in my opinion, too. So this sparks a whirlwind of press. Songs are written about her. T-shirts are sold with the slogan, Run, Bambi, Run. Whoa. Bumper stickers, everything. It blows up. It's covered on America's Most Wanted. Like, it is everywhere. And she actually has a lot of supporters who believe her and her innocence.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that support and that notoriety that she gets ultimately is her downfall, because a tourist who had heard about her escape on America's Most Wanted spots her and turns her in after a few months.
Ugh.
And she and Dominic are deported back to the United States. Dominic eventually is sentenced to 1 year in prison for his involvement, and Lori is actually put in solitary confinement for a year while her attorney works on her case. And I just have to say, solitary confinement is cruel and unusual punishment. Yes, and I can't imagine spending a year, and I don't care who it is, I don't care what crime they committed, that is inhumane, and this woman did not deserve that.
And there's so much science that proves after a certain point threshold, which is like somewhere around 2 weeks, like it's not long at all, that it like causes like permanent mental damage.
Well, I mean, I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast before, but the story of Kalief Browder, who died by suicide after spending 3 years in Rikers waiting for trial because right. he didn't actually commit a crime, and he was ultimately his charges were dropped or he was found innocent. Regardless, 3 years in Rikers, and a lot of that was spent in solitary because he was being so brutalized there. And when he ultimately left Rikers, he died by suicide not long after. Yes. So we know that the impact that this can have.
And if that's something you want to hear more about as an experience, I really recommend Solitary by Albert Woodfox. He passed away recently, but he spent somewhere near 40 years in solitary confinement. Yeah.
That's disgusting. While Lori is in solitary confinement, her attorney is working on her case. the Canadian government, when they deported her, actually lobbied, or I guess extradited in this situation, the Canadian government actually lobbied for her to get a new look at her trial. They heard her complaints about how the case was handled and how she felt like she was being targeted. And they said, look, we're sending you back, but we do think that you should have your case re-looked at. And so she eventually agrees to drop her appeal, her most recent appeal, in exchange for that case to be re-examined.
That was a very like diplomatic political move of them.
It was
being like, we're not going to not send her back and get the U.S. mad at us, but we're also not going to have people mad at us by acting like we're kind of
fine. Well, and I will say, from this review of her case, this judicial review, they didn't find any evidence of police or prosecutorial crime, because of course they didn't, but they did find a lot of mistakes about how the police handled the case, including like chain of custody issues. So she was granted a new trial.
Okay.
Rather than risk a second conviction, and because she got a deal, she pleads no contest to second degree murder. I think a lot of people don't necessarily know what no contest means, but basically it's, you're saying you're not going to fight the charges, but you're also not saying that you did it. So when she pleads no contest to second degree murder, she's sentenced to 20 years, which is commuted to time served. So she was released from custody 3 hours after that hearing, after serving a little over 10 years.
Wow.
She kept fighting to clear her name, even after being released, up until her death in 2010, to, I believe, liver disease. And her attorney continues to seek a posthumous pardon to this day.
Wow.
So that's the case. And I think, you know, what we were saying earlier, like, there's so many cops involved that are bad. And Lori, there's questions to her guilt.
Yeah.
And questions about the guilt of her husband and her friend. I think let's do a little thought experiment. Say Lori didn't do it and she was framed. The logical person who framed her would be her husband. And he used his police connections to do it. You know, he lied about being on duty and never was held accountable for that.
Right. I mean, there's so much in this story, like, from the get with her, get where she got fired. Like, there's so much in this story where it's like, okay, cops.
Well, she got fired for smoking weed.
Right. Which we've covered how many stories where police are on trial for murder and
still got
fired.
And to be clear, I don't think cops should commit crime, but you're firing people for smoking weed.
Yeah. And I'm also, and like, you're letting people think cops should commit crime, because I don't think cops should exist.
Yeah. Like, you're firing people for smoking weed, but you're letting the guy who shot another cop just still run around.
Exactly.
It sounds like Lori had a point when she talked about this double standard that she saw. And another thing, so, you know, her argument is that's part of why she was targeted, is that she was speaking out against corruption and discrimination within the department. But there's also rumors, some evidence, allegedly she was involved in a more formal investigation of corruption within the police department. So,
which is definitely noteworthy.
It is noteworthy. Ultimately, I think something we talk about in these cases is, like, was the community better served with her in prison? I don't think so.
I don't think so
either. I don't think so. And I feel like a lot of times we talk about these cases and we're like, yeah, that guy needed to go out. I don't know. I don't know that the community was safer with her in prison.
No, I don't think
so. I will say, it sounds like she contributed to that prison. I think the fact that she created a prison newspaper, that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, right. I don't think prison is ever, like, a good thing or serving us, but I do think that in our current system, there are some cases where we, especially when it's cops, you know, y'all love the system, where it makes, where we have to put, isolate people from community for at least some time. And this just does not feel like that whatsoever. I'm just not convinced. The wig getting flushed down the toilet gives me lots of pause. Lots and lots of pause.
I have reasonable doubt. That's all I'm going to say. Mm. I have reasonable doubt. Period. Which I kind of hate. Like, y'all know me. I want to be the person that's like, this dirty cop committed this crime. I do think a dirty cop committed this crime. I just don't know if it's the person who was actually punished for it.
Yeah,
which I exactly. think speaks to the larger conversation that we started at the beginning of this episode, is that even within policing, there's so much inequity just in the way that the officers are treated.
Mm-hmm. And who thinks that that wouldn't transfer out into the way that they enforce laws? If they enforce it even within their own precinct in so inequitably, how would that not be how they enforce it in the world? Like, that if A plus B equals C, like,
if 2 + 2 = 4,
literally,
then what the fuck is this? Like, that's such a great point that I didn't even like fully think of. Like, how can you tell me that the police aren't racist and sexist and bigoted when they're racist and sexist and bigoted to their brothers in blue, to the people that they are the most loyal to? To the only people that they actually seem to care about within this terrible system.
Yep. It's truly crazy.
It's. I mean, what is there to say? If y'all want to know more about this case, like I said, Lori has a documentary. There's some interesting legacy media articles about it, but like I said, I don't really love the reporting that was done around this, but Lori seems like a really interesting person.
Yeah.
As far as the people we've covered, I think she's like one of the more interesting, less evil people. But I think,
honestly, and the legacy media might just be interesting to listen to in contrast to this episode.
Yeah,
like, it might be an interesting case study.
For sure. I think just to in this episode, let's talk about like what justice would even look like in this, because these kids,
right,
they've lost their mother,
mm-hmm.
they've lost their stepmother, and their dad kind of seems like a dick. So how did our system deliver them any sort of justice?
Right,
how did our system do anything to take care of them? And how could it have in a system that was not the one that we are currently in?
It's really crazy that, even when we were just talking about this case, I wasn't thinking about them because they were not at all considered in our justice process, our quote unquote justice process.
And like, I mean, we've talked about this in episodes in the past. They're kind of the ultimate victims in this situation.
Yeah, they're the living
people who have to live with what has happened. And, you know, I'm sure they're still out there today, like, reconciling with that.
Yeah.
I think about Sean, who is sure that it was a man that killed his mother. Do you think that he sleeps well at night knowing that the only person that ever was held accountable for that murder was a woman?
Right. Or even just, like, in what ways were they helped to go through those healing processes? Like, I don't, like, did they have easily accessible mental health care? Did they have like community members that were stepping in to be various different aspects of a maternal figure to them? Like,
and I think, I mean, hey, maybe that 19-year-old in Florida, but I think something that when we talk about any case, I want people to start thinking about is we need to find a way to support victims outside of our justice system.
Mm-hmm.
So those kids, like you were just saying, getting them good access to mental health care, 100%. Getting them a surrogate maternal figure in their life. Getting them, I mean, I what else could support them? Like,
yeah, just as much support as possible. Yeah, I mean, I agree that that should happen at, like, that in our current system, that should be happening outside our justice system. But I'm also like that's what the advocacy for actions like restorative justice are, is that, like, the people that should be centered in the justice process are the people that are the most intimately affected, and that the people who are the most intimately affected, especially in murder cases, are just not even part of the equation when it comes to what justice looks like.
Yeah. I think something I want to encourage people to do always, but after this episode, look up restorative justice models.
Mm-hmm.
Look up them within your own community. There are some jurisdictions within the United States that offer some sort of restorative justice work, whether it be mediation, because I mean, maybe mediation, and I feel like in this case, not really, because the guilt of Lori is questionable, but I actually think mediation can be a really useful tool in getting past crime.
Yeah. I mean, the first step to mediation is that the person who's caused harm is ready to take ownership of the harm they've caused. So obviously that's more difficult here, but maybe it wouldn't have been maybe if this is a framing, this whole crime wouldn't have happened if we didn't have the justice system the way that it is. Like, who knows? But
I think this also just, this case shows that the justice system, it does work better for rich white people and people with power, but even for them, mm-hmm. it doesn't work that great, because here was a woman who was a former police officer who, whether she is guilty or not, very clearly did not get a fair trial.
Yeah.
So if she can't even get a fair trial, do you think that young Black men, young poor people with no power, with no societal power, can?
Yeah. No one advocating for them. Nope. I think that's a really important point.
So, crazy episode. We'll be back next week with another one. We'll be back next week with some cops in the culture, some current events.
Exactly.
And anything you want to plug at the end of this episode, Chris?
Just our Instagram and our TikTok. Instagram at Thin Blue Crime Pod, TikTok at Thin Blue Crime.
Also, if there's like a current event that you want us to cover as part of Cops in the Culture, let us know.
Yes,
especially with Cops in the Culture, like, really tell us. That's where, if something's happening in your community, we can talk about it.
Yeah, if you guys want anything on Cops in the Culture, through that Instagram, hit that Instagram, because I'll be there.
Well, hope y'all have a good week. Hope y'all liked this episode. Hope y'all don't mind the kind of shift in how we're operating. If you do, honestly, tell us, because maybe we have to shift again. Like, we're trying to find ways to make things better for you, because it's all about y'all, the listeners. It's all about you.
It is really exciting, the like community building that's happening, and that this is like part of, now that we are in season two, I'm like, wait, we have a podcast, like, for real now.
No, we literally have a podcast.
I don't know when we're ever gonna stop saying that. Like, when will it be season 15? Can you believe
we actually have a podcast? What? Well, hopefully y'all stick around for as long as we are still able to do this. I promise you, cops are gonna still be committing crimes, so there's always gonna be something for us to talk about.
Yep, never run out of material.
All right, see y'all next week.
See you next week. Bye.